Paris Marsh grew up in rural Kansas in the 1980s and 90s. It was a time in the country where the wealth gap widened. Last year, I had the chance to talk with Sarah about her book, Heartland, a memoir of working hard and being broke in the richest country on earth. Since then, it was on everybody's top list, from National Public Radio to Publishers Weekly to becoming a finalist for the National Book Award. It's just come out in paperback. I'm happy to say that Sarah Smarsh is back with us on KAXE, KBXE. Sarah, thanks so much for being here.
Hi, Heidi. Thanks for having me back.
So I want to start with a quote from Heartland. You write, "Something about my family was peculiar and willfully ignored in the modern story of our country." What do you mean by that, and when did you come to realize that?
So what I have been writing about for many years as a journalist, and what is also the prevailing theme of Heartland, is socioeconomic class as an issue, as well as an identity marker in this country. And it's an issue for which we historically have done a very poor job of articulating. So when I was a first-generation college student at the University of Kansas in 1998, I was sensing that there was an otherness, let's say, about me on campus, even though I am a white woman, and so am definitely on the privilege end of the race continuum. Nonetheless, my family had deeply struggled economically. On top of that, I grew up largely and mostly rural. And while there are, and I bet some of your listeners can appreciate this, there are stereotypes in some contingents of this country that, like, everyone in Kansas is a farmer. And actually, growing up as a fifth-generation farm kid in the 80s and 90s, I was an extreme minority within the state of Kansas for still being part of the small family farming community. So that's a long way of saying that basically the fact that I was from a poor rural upbringing made me something apart on a college campus that was mostly populated by middle and maybe a few upper middle class kids, even at a state university. And there was no word for what I was. You know, if my otherness were for being a woman of color or indigenous, or let's even a member of the LGBTQ community, there was a campus group for that. But my particular angle of disadvantage was something that was hard for me to understand even existed, because no one was talking about it.
So in hearing that, some people may say, well, you must have pulled yourself up by your bootstraps. You know, here you are, you're a successful author and journalist. But that notion of bootstraps, you know, is set on one group of people who wrote it and who fit into that stereotype of being urban and having money and probably being male. Can you talk about the concept of that?
Sure. Well, I would say this, the pulling oneself up by one's bootstraps idea is one of the foundational myths of this nation. And by that I mean we've been calling ourselves a meritocracy and a democracy for centuries. And all you have to do is look at the data to know that that isn't entirely true. Is there opportunity and class mobility in this country that in global terms makes it a pretty good place to be born? I would say yes. And all the same, this idea that all you have to do is work hard and have some smarts or skills, and then you will see fair and just returns for that input, is hardly the story for, I would argue, the vast majority of Americans. There are 40 million people living in poverty in this country right now, and the vast majority of them work themselves to the bone every day, every week, year-round, my family included. And I can assure folks, and I bet some of your listeners know firsthand, that that in fact it does take more than hard work and gumption and smarts and skill to even have a livable wage, let alone financial comfort. The system is really sort of rigged against hardworking people who are born to economic disadvantage.
And that myth, like you said, makes it seem like it is all your individual responsibility to get that success. So if you are growing up in a rural area, you have ideas, you know, to be a poet, to be creative, to start a business, to do this kind of thing. And those things don't quite happen because you might be working a couple jobs and taking care of your kids. then it feels like you personally failed rather than realizing, like, this system isn't quite set up for me.
Mm-hmm. That's so well said. And I think that that is at the heart of the personal aspects of the narrative in Heartland, is this sense that I had growing up that the people around me, while they were very proud, hardworking, brilliant, creative, resilient, you know, all of those things were true. And yet there was a sort of unspoken sadness or sense of guilt or self-blame within our own community and family for, you know, I would hear my grandma talk about some of the extreme struggles of her very young life, being born into a much more severe version of poverty than myself as a female, I'd say a teen mother in the 1960s. Hearing her talk about the one small moment when she applied for public benefits because lacking economic agency and having just escaped an abusive marriage as a teenage kid with a baby, she couldn't get by with her waitressing job. So she temporarily was on, as she would say, on the dole. And she was so ashamed of that when she told me the story, and it just broke my heart. We have created this culture and dialogue in which, as you say, that the undercurrent of assumption that our outcomes are somehow related to our own character and merit and hard work means that if those outcomes feel and appear quite negative, then you think that you yourself must be at fault.
We're talking with Sarah Smarsh. Her book is out in paperback. It's called Heartland, a memoir of working hard and being broke in the richest country on earth. As I talk to you, I sit on the edge of the Iron Range of northern Minnesota, where the economy has changed so much over the years. And a lot of people want to stay. You know, they have ties to this region, but especially if you show some potential in school, you're told you got to get out. There's nothing here for you, kid. You got to go find something else. I wonder if you heard that or what that was like for you as you were growing up.
Sure. So I grew up mostly on a wheat and cattle farm about 30 miles west of Wichita. So not deep rural isolation, but of quite rural life nonetheless. And this is pre-digital era. So I, not even social media connecting me to any world other than what I saw outside our farmhouse door. And I definitely picked up messages that the way of life I had been born to was somehow waning. I hate to use the word dying, but that was definitely thrown around. And the 80s was a moment when we, for the first time as a country, started using the term the farm crisis. Decades of policy that sort of tore at rural areas were coming to a head, with farm after farm going under, the small town storefronts closing. That was the backdrop of my childhood. So I sometimes describe it as having grown up, I'm growing and coming of age in a place that itself is dwindling and perceived as dying, not by its own fault, I would add, but just these bigger structural forces that a tiny little hamlet in the Midwest couldn't contend with. And so I can't say that anyone ever directly said to me, you need to get out of this place. I just absorbed it through popular culture, every representation of a, financially stable and respectable family or woman was a middle-class urban image in, conversations about farm life. I heard loud and clear from my family's complaints about everything from the government to corporations that we were on the losing end of some sort of battle, no matter how hard we tried. And there was certainly no pressure for my generation, at least that I saw, to keep that going, in that our forebears knew that what a hard life it would be for us, maybe even harder than it had been for them. And so it wasn't an overt encouragement to get out, and yet nonetheless I absorbed and understood that the goals that I had for myself, quite humble goals of economic stability, just a life with some peace about it rather than worrying about whether the bills would be covered, meant that I would have to go somewhere with statistically better economic odds.
You mentioned social media, and there's a part of your book that just cements kind of the whole message of it to me, because you said you were kind of innocent of what your own image was. And so then, you know, going back as a journalist, knowing what you know now and seeing that photo of you where you say that you look like a little old man in the shape of a little girl, can you kind of explain that and what you saw in that as an adult rather than what you remember about being that little girl?
Sure. So I'm 39, and just in the four decades of my life, there has been a dramatic transformation in just, you know, everything from the way we do photography to the way we see ourselves and create an image of ourselves. And you use the term innocence from my book. I do think that my having been, you know, I should add that child in the 80s and an adolescent in the 90s, those were decades where very major media shifts happened for middle-class America, specifically that being cable TV in the 1980s and the internet in the 1990s. We didn't get a hold of those things until much later, and so I grew up without those things. We didn't even have air conditioning in our farmhouse, and I still sleep with the windows open to this day, actually. Because of that, I just, there was no, what I can see now as somebody who thinks a lot about media because I'm part of it, I see how we as a culture have shifted into this mode of sort of constant self-presentation and a kind of ever-present awareness of our own image. And, you know, that's everything from posting smiling pictures on Facebook to filters that change the way that our face looks on Instagram, tagging a location to let people know that you're at some cool spot or whatever. And sometimes that is mixed up in what I would call the idea of rural or country America. So I will see, you know, like hashtags for farm life, and I'm thinking, like, farm chic ain't what I grew up with, but that's cute. Anyway, this is a long way of saying that when I was a kid, I look back at pictures like the one you just mentioned, and I get a kick out of how few photos I'm smiling. I was a largely happy kid, you know, definitely a kind of serious future artist temperament, but I was, you know, I was a smiley, laughing child, and in photos I look very often quite, you know, grim isn't the right word, but I'm not like performing for the camera. Nobody in my world suggested that I should, and the photos seem like a more accurate documentation of what was going on, which was a mix of all kinds of emotions and hard work and struggle and, you know, fun birthdays and holidays. So I was, I don't think this is an appropriate term anymore, but when I was a kid, we would have called me a tomboy, and that was, nobody had any problem with that. We were out in the middle of nowhere with very little, you know, notions of like gender expectations, which is counter, I think, to a lot of people's assumption about that place and in relation to progress and identity politics. And so I just kind of followed my grandpa around the farm and liked hanging out with my dad on construction sites. And I see now, looking back, that I, while I'm definitely a woman, I had a more kind of masculine force in me, and that was well suited to the environment, because often, as a lot of your listeners know, that's required for the sort of work that's to be done.
Growing up, knowing the value or just the necessity of hard work, has that stuck with you as an adult, as your life now as a journalist?
Oh, absolutely. It's so deep in me, Heidi, that I can't even... It's just the water I swim in, and so rather than me perceiving it, just so once in a while I get a reminder that it's not how everyone experiences the world. So some examples would be that I take deadlines very seriously in journalism and in book writing, and I often hear back from editors like they're sort of surprised that I'm actually sending something on the date that I was told to send it. There are all sorts of ways that when you have an economic cushion and the potential freedom or power that can come with that in a professional environment, I found that can cause people to, what am I trying to say here? I guess what I'm trying to say is if you grow up knowing that if you lose your job, you're not going to be able to pay the next bill, or if you don't get your butt out into the field, your whole family is going to suffer for you sitting on your behind, there is no perceived room for error. And, you know, my dad would be a perfect example of this. He's a 64-year-old construction worker, and to my knowledge, he's never missed a day of work in his life that wasn't for some sort of, like, absolutely rare, you know, like devastating level of sickness. And so, you know, this is one of the, I guess, kind of beautiful gifts of my upbringing in a sense, is that I know that I can always count on myself to deliver on a job.
So let's talk about what it's been like since Heartland first came out. On the write-up of the paperback, it says that it's part of a chorus of voices growing louder in the zeitgeist. I'm wondering if that's what it felt like to you, and what it's been like to travel the country, to talk to different people, and maybe even differences between urban people and rural people reading your work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I would say, you know, as to that zeitgeist, in the writing process, it certainly did not feel that way. It felt like I was the only person saying what I was trying to write. And that may be because I actually got my first research grant to start working on the book in 2002 when I was a senior at the University of Kansas. And I worked on it for about 10 years before I, and then tucked it away and sort of gave up on it when I couldn't get an agent. 2015, I finally got a book deal and finished the project, and here we are. But during those years where it was just sort of me in a creative gestation, which proved to be a very long process because I was, you know, holding three jobs to pay the bills, that doesn't leave much time for writing. In addition to, you know, I was trying to articulate something that, for me at least, no one else had said, to create some sort of precedent. It was a long journey that felt and lonely. And then one of the beautiful, incredible outcomes of it having been published, and maybe this is why the universe needed the timing to wait, is that it does feel like at this moment in very recent political memory, we had an election shakeup, and there's now this sort of dialogue or discourse about a quote-unquote rural-urban divide. The country is talking about socioeconomic class, perhaps in clunky and lacking terms, but it's at least being looked at. You know, researchers and activists have been doing that work along the way, but what I'm talking about right now is a mainstream collective consciousness, and that does seem to have shifted in fairly recent years, and it has been absolutely heartening and incredible to travel the country for the last year, as well as even the world, talking to people about these themes, which are indeed global themes. There's a very specific signature to the way it looks in this particular country. There is something afoot where people are waking up to both the injustice of the historic wealth inequality we find ourselves in the midst of, as well as the political and policy and government elements that have led us to that place. That sort of awakening is, for me as a civic-minded person, very exciting to behold. And then just in a more personal way, you know, to have people of all backgrounds come through lines at my book signings and events and say, I grew up in the Bronx, but your Grandma Betty is my Grandma Sue. Or if I'm in a rural space, for someone to say, you know, you have written a story that for me was the first time that allowed me to see myself on the page. These are like the honors of my life. And the unfortunate thing it tells us about our country is that the subtitle of my book, which involves working hard and being broke in the richest country on earth, is an unfortunately extremely common experience that, and it's sort of a tie that binds across all sorts of identity lines. And that's a sad fact about the country, but it has been extremely inspiring to connect with so many people who say, I lived that too, and let's figure out how to make it better for future generations.
Before we go, I want to hear about Homecomers. It's your new podcast that I've had a chance to listen to, and I love, and I wonder what you plan for kind of continuing this conversation through this podcast.
Sure. Thanks for asking. I'm really excited about this. I mentioned how long that book writing journey was, and I really needed to like get away from the laptop screen and get back to my roots as a journalist and interview people and interact in real time. And so I shifted to this podcast medium temporarily. Ford Foundation and Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, as well as the Shorenstein Center on Politics, Media, and Public Policy at Harvard, all supported me in for a couple of years of exploring this project that's really about folks who are challenging that get out narrative that you and I were talking about earlier. So they are native sons and daughters of places like the Black Belt, which is a crescent-shaped region across the American South that is largely African-American and historically quite poor. They grew up among farm workers in the Central Valley of California and immigrant communities or indigenous communities in the Midwest. Let's see, one of my guests is the daughter of a coal miner in Appalachia. These are people who are from the places where we are told to, quote-unquote, get out in order to, quote-unquote, make it. And while those economic tides are understandable reasons for that sort of move, these are people who have very intentionally, against all odds, either returned to or refused to leave the places that feel like home to them. And so The Homecomers is me interviewing these folks about how they're doing that, why it matters to them, as well as just, you know, providing a real in-depth portrait of these places that they're from. Sometimes the national media just uses this broad brushstroke about rural America. Well, this is a vast continent-wide country and with millions of people in that rural space who are, while headlines would suggest otherwise, incredibly diverse in all ways, politically, racially, culturally. And so that's what I'm kind of trying to reveal.
Homecomers is available anywhere you get podcasts from, and we'll also have a link on our website at kexe.org. Sarah Smarsh, her book is out in paperback, Heartland, a memoir of working hard and being broke in the richest country on earth. Hope to talk to you again, Sarah. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Heidi. Call it living the dream. Call it